Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, September 24, 2020. Illinois impact, new cases up on U of I campus, 7-day positivity rate down in Champaign County. Kudos to Arthur's Dick's Pharmacy from the Douglas County Health Department. The business, known for its old-fashioned soda fountain, is the first to be recognized by the county for COVID-19 prevention, part of a new campaign. The 7-day positivity rate on campus remains 0.3%, despite the U of I reporting its largest single-day increase in new cases in 2 weeks, 62, from 11,030 tests, 0.6%. That ends a 13-day stretch without a rate higher than 0.5%. Meanwhile, Champaign County's 7-day rate declined for the fourth straight day from 0.8% to 0.7%. The number of county residents hospitalized with COVID-19 remained 4, while recovered cases rose by 57 to 4,046. 231 of Champaign County's 304 active cases are in CU, the highest totals elsewhere. Mahomet, 14 plus 4 from Tuesday, St. Joseph, 13 plus 1, Rantoul, 12, even, Savoy, 9 plus 2. Of Vermilion County's 570 confirmed cases, 96 are classified as active, with 7 residents hospitalized. At 4.4%, the county's 7-day positivity rate remains higher than the state's 3.5%. And a big photo and a headline, Ready, Set, Vote, Election 2020. And the caption under the photo, above, Champaign County Clerk Aaron Amons and IT Specialist Rashawn Hutchison prepare for today's first day of early in-person voting Wednesday in the gymnasium at Brookins Administrative Center. Below, one of the ballot drop boxes. Daily Double. In-person voting kicks off, mail ballots set out. Are you ready to vote? Early voting for the November 3rd election was set to get underway at 8:30 a.m. today in Champaign County, and in-person early voters will have an entire gymnasium to line up, spread out, and practice social distancing while casting their ballots. Champaign County Clerk Aaron Amons moved the start of in-person early voting from his office to the much larger gym in the Brookins Administrative Center, 1776 East Washington Street, Urbana. Parking for the gym is on the north side of the building off Art Bartell Road. Amons has been encouraging voters to use the vote-by-mail option in the interest of safety amid the coronavirus pandemic. But the next safest way to vote this year will be in person early to avoid lines and limit potential COVID-19 exposure, he said. In-person voters expect to find Champaign County election judges behind plexiglass panels 6 feet apart and equipped with gloves and disinfectant spray. Voting stations will also be distanced. Voters are asked to wear a mask and use hand sanitizer when they arrive, Amons said. Vote-by-mail ballots for most of the voters who have applied so far in Champaign County are set to hit the mail today. Amons said about 25,000 vote-by-mail applications have been received, and ballots for 23,000 of them were to be mailed today. The other applications are still being processed, and those ballots will be mailed in the next wave around October 5th, he said. If the pace picks up on vote-by-mail applications between now and October 29th, Amons projected as many as 35,000 Champaign County voters may be using that option. Vote-by-mail applications have slowed down to a few dozen a day, though, compared with hundreds a day soon after his office mailed applications to voters, Amons said. In-person versus mail. This election is coming with a lot of changes, he said, but it needn't be as complicated as some voters think. I think if voters embrace the changes, it will not be as complicated as they think, because no one is obligated to vote by mail, Amons said. In-person voting is still an option for anyone. Some voters have viewed the push for voting by mail this year to be limiting their options, but it's actually broadening options, Amons said. This is actually increasing your opportunity and flexibility, he said. Anyone who applies to vote by mail and then decides to vote in person instead can do that, Amons said. Those voters would just need to bring their mailed ballots to an election judge to invalidate them and give them a new ballot to vote in person, he said. On the other hand, those who don't apply to vote by mail could end up being out of luck come Election Day if they become infected with COVID-19 or are exposed to an infected person and are placed in quarantine or isolation after it's too late to apply to vote by mail, Amon said. Drop boxes coming soon. Vote-by-mail ballots won't necessarily have to be placed in the mail. The clerk's office has received the drop boxes it ordered, and those are being installed at 7 Champaign-Urbana locations over the next few days by county staff members. Amon said he anticipates all drop boxes are being installed and ready to receive ballots by Sunday or Tuesday at the latest. Early voting was moved from the clerk's office to the Brookings Gym, and not just for the larger space the gym offers. Amon said his office needed the usual voting area to use as a vote-by-mail processing room that will include a mail sorter, mail opening machine, mail station for ballots picked up by election judges from both parties, and signature verification area. Voter signatures on certification envelopes will be scanned and compared to those on file, Amon said. Election judges from both parties will be doing the verification and won't touch the ballots but will compare signatures on a screen, he said. All signatures are assumed to be good unless a challenge arises, he said. While early voting is getting underway at the Brookings Gym, 11 other early voting locations around the county will also become available starting October 19th. As early voting also gets underway today across the state, Vermilion County is among a handful of counties offering a new accessible vote-by-mail option. This is a new option available through the State Board of Elections, and it will allow visually impaired people to vote privately on their own in their own homes. Previously, those who are vision impaired and not able to vote in person would have to rely on someone's help in filling out a vote-by-mail ballot. So their votes weren't entirely private, according to Lindsay Light, Chief Deputy County Clerk in Vermilion County. Voters who would like to access this new program can contact the clerk's office and request an accessible ballot, Light said. Those voters will receive pins to access their ballots electronically and can fill them out using their own assistive technology, print their completed ballots, and deliver them to the clerk's office or put them in the mail, Light said. Matt Dietrich, spokesman for the State Board of Elections, said accessible vote-by-mail was just rolled out in the last couple weeks. 10 counties and the city of Bloomington will be participating so far, and 5 other counties are considering this option, according to the State Board. Council asked to allow for complaints based on videos. At its meeting Wednesday, the Urbana Civilian Police Review Board asked the City Council to let police complaints be based on videos. The ordinance currently says complaints shall be based upon a first-hand account, either by the person involved in the incident or a witness to the incident. The board approved the recommendations to the city by a vote 5-0, as 2 of its seats remain vacant. In July, the board kept a physical presence requirement in the complaint form, with some board members saying that they were limited by the language of the ordinance, which would be up to the council to change. Member Scott Dossett also argued that allowing video-based complaints could lead to a large amount that could slow down the board. Member Ricardo Diaz said Wednesday that while he understands that, he didn't think it should prevent the change. He also asked what should happen if the victim doesn't want to file a complaint, but a third party does. That's not a problem, Member Tony Allegretti said, because they're not going to be brought forward in front of the board. That doesn't preclude us from reviewing it. He said the board wouldn't necessarily need to hear from the victim because it's more of a concern of was this the proper procedure. The victim could decline to be a witness, just like the officer involved doesn't come before our board and discuss what happened. We have a representative of the officer, Allegretti said. Austin's place leaders ready to hand over reins. 8 small rooms, a break room, and a large bathroom sit empty in the back of the CU at Home's Phoenix Drop-In Center on the northern edge of downtown Champaign. Soon, the dingy tiles will be replaced with gleaming new floors. The rooms will be furnished with 2 bed frames and mattresses apiece, and the rooms looking out to Market Street will be made into an intake office for Austin's Place, the year-round women's shelter that will occupy the building. When the renovations are finished in the next few months, it will be the actualization of years of talk, planning, and fundraising for Kelly Kemper and Kim Stanholt and their staff at Austin's Place Women's Shelter, which will be making the move into the building. We're just really excited to get the women into a new space and have everything be fresh and nice and new, Kemper said. The co-leaders of the shelter, both of whom volunteer after working their full-time jobs during the day, are handing off the reins to full-time staff at CU at Home. When that brand new office is occupied, complete with a large window that looks out onto the sidewalk, and those beds donated by Illini Mattress are filled, Kemper and Stanhope will be taking a step back from a shelter they've molded over the last 6 years. It's bittersweet because we put a lot of heart and soul, blood, sweat, and tears into it over the years, Kemper said. We're super excited for it to move onto this new level because it's obviously needed in the community, and it's not something that we can do, but we're really excited that CU at Home and the men's shelter are willing and able. Until earlier this year, Austin's Place was based at the First United Methodist Church. Due to safety precautions surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic, the shelter moved into hotel rooms for a few months before moving into New Covenant Fellowship during the summer. Over the summer, CU at Home began to take over operations of Austin's Place, including having paid staff supervise the shelter overnight instead of the volunteers who have historically staffed Austin's Place. Whereas women used to have to check in with Courage Connection, which provides services to victims of domestic violence, before staying at the shelter, they can now come directly to the shelter at any time of night. At its new space, 14 women will be able to occupy 7 small separate rooms, which will not have doors. They'll come in through a separate entrance off of Market Street, which is being redone into a space that will be completely locked off from the men's shelter. The nice thing about it is that it gives the women some sense of privacy, even though we're taking the doors off, Kemper said. It also allows us, too, if we have women with substance abuse issues. They will still be able to come in, but the women that are working on their sobriety will be able to stay separate from those women. It doesn't provide that temptation for the women that's trying to stay clean. Since October 31st of last year, when CU at Home became a year-round shelter, CU at Home Director Rob Dahlhaus III said 470 different men have stayed there. During that time, 100 different women have stayed at Austin's Place at one time or another. In August, the shelter has hosted 50 to 60 men almost every night, Dahlhaus said, while Austin's Place has hosted around a dozen since moving to New Covenant. It's interesting that the emergency shelter numbers were so high in August because we haven't had an emergency shelter open in August in this community in almost 20 years, Dahlhaus said. That's eye-opening, and it gives us a little bit of a glimpse of what down the road will look like. Who knows what this winter will look like? It just shows us the need of having that resource in the community. The numbers are staggering. CU at Home recently launched a campaign to enlist 600 monthly donations of $40. That amount of money would fully fund the operating costs of both a men's and women's shelter year-round, men's and women's year-round shelters, Dahlhaus said. As of Thursday, 76 monthly donors had signed up. Donors can enlist at cuathome.us. Renovations will officially begin when the contractor receives final approval from the city and should be ready sometime in the next few months. While Kemper said it'll be a bittersweet moment to hand over the reins to Austin's Place to CU at Home, she knows the new shelter will provide services the old shelter couldn't. CU at Home offers social services, transportation, transitional housing, and a daily drop-in center, and also helps the homeless connect with other services in the area. As board members, she and Stanhope will still have their fingerprints on the organization as it begins a new chapter. We're not necessarily turning our backs and walking away, but we definitely need to hand it over and let the professionals take over, Kemper said. I don't think that we'll ever be able to completely walk away from it. I think it'll be something that will help keep us involved for a long time to come. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Cheryl Gadbury called to renew her subscription this week. No offense to Lauren Tate, but it's another byline that drew her back to our print edition. Her granddaughter, Haley Gadbury, is Bement High School's student reporter for Year 5 of High School Confidential, which kicks off Friday. Haley is continuing a family tradition started by her sister, Sydney, who covered the Bulldogs like a pro for HSC in 2017-18. I'm very proud of both of them, said Cheryl, 71, living in Monticello. The daughters of Tim, Bement class of 92, and Stacy, Hayworth class of 94, Haley and Sydney are the first set of siblings to write for HSC. HSC remains heavily involved at Bement, cheerleading. Haley remains heavily involved at Bement, cheerleading, basketball, track, choir, band, National Honor Society, with plans on studying sports medicine in college. Sydney, who kept just as busy in high school, is in line to graduate from Parkland College in May. They even get along, Mom said. Well, it depends on the day, Stacy said. They might do it to each other, but they'll never let anyone else pick on the other. There's another photo with the headline, Raising Their Game, and the caption of the photo, employees of Area Erectors Incorporated install a prefabricated wall panel as work continues Wednesday on the new gymnasium and cafeteria at Edison Middle School in Champaign. The panels each measure 42 feet tall by 10 feet wide and weigh 29 tons. A new look for old school, including gym and cafeteria. While Edison Middle School students are learning from home, its new gymnasium and cafeteria is taking shape. Employees of Area Erectors Incorporated install prefabricated wall panels Wednesday at the school's campus on West Green Street. Those walls will encompass a much larger than the cramped space that teachers and coaches have been forced to deal with, where over 100 kids were crammed onto a tiny basketball court during gym class. The old gym was demolished this summer to make way for the new one, along with the new cafeteria, part of a $25.8 million project that includes new administrative spaces, new mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems, new windows, and other small renovations around the building. The district planned on having Edison's sixth graders move to the old Columbia School at Bradley Avenue and Neal Street for this school year while renovations were completed. With Dr. Howard Elementary's 1910 building demolished and built anew over the last 2 years, and Columbia, built in 1905, now serving only as a temporary home, Edison is the district's oldest active school. Built in 1914 with updates in 1933 and 1956, Edison has 10 years on Southside Elementary and is 21 years older than Central High School. And we have Jim Dye's column. As the state's finances fall from bad to worse, where's the bottom? The people of Illinois can run, but they can't hide from the Illinois bad news that is engulfing them. On Monday, S&P Global Ratings issued a gloomy financial analysis that suggested the state's already anemic bond rating is in danger of falling into non-investment grade. Junk. Status. That came on the heels of a report by Chicago-based Truth in Accounting that ranked Illinois' financial standing as the second worst in the nation. It finished number 49, just ahead of number 50, New Jersey. The Truth in Accounting report said Illinois went into the coronavirus pandemic in dire fiscal health, and it will probably come out of the crisis even worse. Illinois' elected officials have made repeated financial decisions that left the state with a debt burden of $226 billion. It states, Illinois financial problems stem mostly from unfunded retirement obligations that have accumulated over the years. Of the $292.1 billion in retirement benefits promised, the state did not fund $144.2 billion in pension and $56.1 billion in retiree health care benefits. Numbers that big can be difficult to comprehend. Breaking them down into smaller, more familiar categories, unpaid bills in the state budget, makes them easier to understand. Owing to revenue shortfalls caused by the state's coronavirus lockdown, the state's unpaid bills have increased from $6.9 billion on June 1st to $7.6 billion on Tuesday. It owes that money to more than 78,000 vendors. At the same time, the state's $43 billion general fund budget, which took effect July 1st, is far out of balance. Governor J.B. Pritzker is relying on borrowing and positive thinking to raise the $6.2 billion needed to balance revenue with planned spending. He's borrowed $5 billion from the Federal Reserve's Municipal Liquidity Fund, a program set up to help states with cash flow problems. The money, however, must be paid back within 3 years. So far, Illinois is the only state to tap that resource. Other states in need of revenue have raised funds by issuing bonds in the open market. Illinois' bond rating, one notch above junk status, is so low that it would have to pay much higher interest rates to sell its bonds than many other states. It's less expensive to go to municipal fund. Pritzker also is counting on an additional $1.2 billion in new revenue that would be forthcoming if his proposed progressive income tax amendment to the Illinois Constitution is approved by voters in November. Pritzker also is hoping that Congress will pass another coronavirus pandemic bailout package. It would be the third that would provide some of the money the state is seeking. Illinois has suffered from severe financial problems for years, the reasons for which are subject to differing opinions. The coronavirus pandemic and statewide economic lockdown devastated a strong economy, causing an estimated $6 billion in lost revenue in the past and current fiscal years. Despite the revenue shortfalls, Pritzker adamantly opposed any reductions in state spending until last week. That's when he ordered state department heads to find potential budget cuts of 5% in the current year and 10% in the budget year that begins July 1, 2021. S&P, however, said it is likely that Illinois will issue bonds or again borrow through the Municipal Liquidity Fund to obtain desired funds. S&P pointed out that a financial problem in one area can lead to others. It said that the cost of Illinois' five public pension plans, which are collectively funded at a level of 40%, will become larger because of the potential for market volatility. Analysts at WirePoints this week issued a report on the state's public pensions, the subject of Tuesday's column, that indicated growing costs are unsustainable and arguing that a state constitutional amendment limiting the growth of future pension costs is necessary to stave off the state's financial collapse. Pritzker spokeswoman Jordan Abdunier, however, denounced both the report and its authors. She called WirePoints analysts Ted Dabrowski, Mark Glenn, and John Clippinger carnival barkers and right-wing ideologues, and said their report shows there is no depth that is too low for them to sink to. S&P is not alone in its dire assessment of the state's flagging financial status. Its views are shared by Fitch Ratings and Moody's Investors Service. This panoply of doom and gloom underscores the reason Pritzker is desperate to pass his income tax amendment that would dramatically expand the state's taxing power. He's already invested $56.5 million from his multi-billion dollar fortune in the campaign to persuade voters to approve it. Capital coverage. Former governor Ryan reflects on historic decision on death penalty. Most soon-to-be former governors on their way out of office keep a low profile as they prepare to pass the torch on to their successor. But that wasn't the case with George Ryan. On January 11, 2003, just 2 days before his term expired, Ryan made international headlines by commuting the sentences of all 167 inmates on Illinois' death row. Now, in a new book, Until I Could Be Sure How I Stopped the Death Penalty in Illinois, the former Republican governor reflects on his painstaking, often emotional journey from being an early supporter of reinstating capital punishment to the man who almost single-handedly brought it down. I guess I was just taking my time, Ryan, now 86, said during an interview when asked why he chose to release the book now. You know, I did what I could while I was there, and I wanted to get it researched and get it done and do it right. A pharmacist from Kankakee, Ryan rose through the ranks of Republican politics in Illinois, first helping run the campaign of former Representative Edward Broome and later winning a seat on the Kankakee County Board of Supervisors. He was elected to the Illinois House in 1972, the same year the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the death penalty nationwide. But the court would reverse itself 4 years later, after several states, including Illinois, adopted new laws that they hoped would meet constitutional muster. The first one in Illinois, passed in 1973, was struck down by the Illinois Supreme Court, but in 1977, the General Assembly enacted another law that would survive court challenges. Drawing extensively from House journals, Ryan recalls the passionate debate over House Bill 10, including the comments of Representative Elroy Sandquist, a Chicago Republican who asked, just as members were about to push their switches to vote yes or no, would you also push your switch to turn on the electricity to take someone's life? Because that's what you're doing when you pull that switch to vote yes. I believed the bill was necessary, Ryan wrote, and so I pressed green to vote yes. The bill passed 118-41 and later sailed through the Senate and was signed into law by then-Governor James Thompson. Ryan would go on to serve as Speaker of the Illinois House from 1981 to 1983, when he became Lieutenant Governor under Governor Jim Edgar. He would serve two terms in that office before being elected Secretary of State in 1990, a post that would eventually bring about his political downfall. But that downfall wouldn't come before he was elected Illinois' 39th governor in 1998. By that time, DNA evidence was becoming widely used to exonerate a number of death row inmates nationwide, and the tactics used by police and prosecutors to obtain murder convictions, including the use of jail snitches, phony evidence, and coerced confessions, were coming under mounting scrutiny. On the day of Ryan's inauguration, the Chicago Tribune published the first in a series of stories about the prosecutorial misconduct that identified nearly 400 murder convictions nationwide, including 46 in Illinois, that had been reversed because prosecutors either failed to turn over evidence of a defendant's innocence or knowingly used false evidence. The Ripper Crew. But Ryan said the turning point for him came 1 month into his term as governor, in February 1999, when Illinois death row inmate Anthony Porter was freed after journalism students at Northwestern University uncovered evidence of his innocence. Porter had been granted a stay of execution in the previous fall when he was just 2 days away from being put to death. That's what caught my attention about the death penalty, Ryan said in an interview. And that kind of a long story that evolved, but it was the fact that I was concerned about the whole system is just prone with error. I mean, it's just got error in every corner. Barely a month later, Ryan allowed an execution to go forward, the only one to occur during his administration, and the last one carried out in Illinois. It involved Andrew Cocorales, who had been convicted of taking part in multiple gruesome murders in the Chicago area by a group of four men who came to be known as the Ripper Crew. And that was very difficult for me to do, Ryan recalled. This guy was a bad guy, Cocorales. He was a terrible guy. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, September 24th, 2020. Please stay tuned for Part 2.